The writer Geraldine Brooks left Australia, where she worked for the Sydney Morning Herald in the early 1980s, to attend the Columbia University graduate program in New York. She had no idea that scholarship would be a life-changing event.
I said, I'm going to be there for the nine-month journalism course, and I'll get my master's, and then I'll come back to Sydney, and I'll get on with my real life. But then I met two important men, and one of them I married, and the other one hired me to work for the Wall Street Journal.
Find out why Geraldine Brooks, who won an Overseas Press Club Award for her Gulf War coverage with fellow writer and husband Tony Horowitz, moved from writing journalism to fiction. We'll also hear her read from her fifth novel, The Secret Chord, which explores the world of the Bible's King David, including the men and women who surrounded him. That's ahead on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. With the publication of The Secret Chord in 2015, Geraldine Brooks now has eight books to her name, three nonfiction and five novels, including March, that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006. Whether she's writing fiction about the American Civil War, the breakup of Yugoslavia, a 17th century Native American, or the ancient Middle East, Brooks always makes good use of her research skills, and she's been rewarded with the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and most recently the 2015 Officer of Australia Honors from the Queen. But how does she blend fact and fiction in her novels?
I'm following the line of fact as far as it leads, but in fiction, I look for stories where you can't write a non-fictional account because there are too many voids in the historical record. The voices have fallen silent, and no matter how much research you do, you can't retrieve them. So the only way to engage with these stories from the past is through imaginative empathy and the exercise of saying, well, maybe, based on what we know, maybe it went something like this.
What was the point that you decided to make the leap from journalism to creative writing?
Well, I would say that the spark of the leap happened when I was lying on the concrete floor of a secret police lockup in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. I was still very much a reporter, a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and I was in Nigeria to investigate allegations that Shell Oil Company was in cahoots with the very brutal military dictatorship of, at that time, Sani Abacha. And the claim was that some very poor subsistence farmers had protested against the despoilation of their lands by Shell and the fact that none of the wealth was being returned to their communities, where there was no school and no clinics and people were just in dire poverty. So they'd had a peaceful protest and Shell had asked Abacha to send in the military and they'd fired on these people. And to be honest, from the distance of New York City, where the Wall Street Journal is based, that didn't seem very plausible that a major oil company would behave that way. So I went to check it out, and sure enough, it was even worse than what had been portrayed to us. So I did the research among the farmers, and I visited villages where there was clear evidence that there had been violent massacre. And I got all my information, and then, as you do as a journalist, I went to the military and said, I need to get your side of this story. What happened here? And instead of giving me an interview, they handed me over to the secret police. And so I'm lying on the floor and I was wondering how long they were going to detain me. And I thought of all the journalists I knew who'd been detained, and my mind went to poor Terry Anderson, kept for 8 years in Beirut. And I thought, holy cow, I am 39 years old, and if they keep me for 8 years, I'll be too old to get pregnant. So when they deported me, mercifully after only 3 days, I went home and I greeted my husband with more than usual enthusiasm. And our son was born the following year.
Oh my gosh. At that point,
I didn't want to be a foreign correspondent anymore with an infant. I didn't want to go off on long open-ended assignments to places where you might get arrested and thrown in the slammer.
You just had a moment of awakening that your life needed to change if you wanted to have a family.
That's right. I loved my journalistic career so much. I loved every step I took. And I guess I had been in denial that, you know, there was a window that was closing. So I'm very grateful to the Nigerian secret police. I feel I owe them my son and my novelistic career. There'd been a story that I'd really stumbled on when I was hiking in England, and I just decided to sit down and see if I could tell it. And that became my first novel, Year of Wonders, which is about the bubonic plague and the unique decision that the villagers of this community took to quarantine themselves voluntarily rather than flee as everybody else did when the plague came.
Looking back over your books, your 2005 March won the Pulitzer Prize. People of the Book came out in 2008 and Caleb's Crossing in 2011. And now you have The Secret Chord. But you started with Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women, which was nonfiction.
That was a reporter's book. Yes, I did that after I'd spent a five-year period covering the Middle East for the Wall Street Journal, and I realized I'd had quite a journey into the lives of the women of that region. And so I took some time off, but it was a leave of absence from journalism. It wasn't another career. It was a real journalist book trying to distill what I'd learned during those years.
Right. It's interesting because you really do look at women in your most recent novel, too, because even though it's about King David from the Old Testament, The Secret Chord definitely gives us some insight into what women feel and believe. I'm thinking about one of his wives when she talks a little bit about how difficult it is.
Well, one of the many interesting things about the story of David, which is so rich, is the number of very clearly drawn women who enter his life. You know, women in the Bible usually get a pretty short shrift, I would say. It's a fairly blokey place, the Old Testament. So, you know, you're lucky if you know the name of a woman. Lot's wife, for example. What's her name? Noah's wife. Again, unnamed. But in David's life, there are some remarkable women, and their stories are told with great economy, but you get a sense of real individuals and very strong personalities. And so for me, one of the temptations of delving into this story was to see if I could widen the viewfinder on these women's experience a little bit and switch the point of view. So instead of seeing them as it appeared to the men in power, give an indication of what these experiences were like from the woman's point of view as these great events were happening to her and around her.
Well, the main character, or the character who is a seer, and do you pronounce it Natan?
I've used the names from the Hebrew scriptures, so Natan, but Natan. In the King James Bible, he's Nathan.
Nathan, right. Yeah. So Natan is a seer, but he's collecting the stories. I marked a passage here about one of the wives. Would you like to read it?
I would be delighted to. This is a passage regarding Michal, who was David's first wife, and she is the daughter of King Saul. So she's a very rare thing in that time, a woman born royal, because Saul, of course, was the first king that the Israelite tribes had experimented with. And she's unusual in the scriptures because her feelings are taken note of. There's a line that says, Michal loved David. And women don't usually get any agency in their marriage, but she's obviously the one who moved to be married to him. But then, because she loves him so much and because she proves loyal to him when her father's regard for him diminishes and he becomes suspicious, Michal chooses David over her father and commits an act of disloyalty to her father for which she is horribly punished. And as a result of this, when she and David are united again 10 years later, she is very bitter. And the marriage devolves into the most sour and corrosive relationship. And it ends in a burst of psychological torture that Michal inflicts on David at a vulnerable moment. And only somebody who knows you intimately could possibly find a way to wound you so deeply. So at this point in the story, she is estranged from David, but he hasn't let her leave the marriage, so she's still part of his court. And Natan has gone to interview her. If age had not ravaged her, life had. Her face was drawn, and her eyes, once lively and compelling, were as dead as a deep well in which the water had long ago been poisoned. The first time I saw her, she was exhausted and had been weeping. But even in her grief on that day, she retained the glow of a woman who is loved and desired. Not now. Not after all the years of estrangements. One that had been forced upon her. One that she had invited. She had always been uncommonly direct for a woman, and I soon discovered that this was still true. I loved him. You know that, I suppose. She had begun to speak, even as I pared my quill. I set down the knife at once and began to write, even though the tip was still imperfect. It is important that you know. I want you to set it down. Mikhail was in love with David. Nobody ever writes that about a woman. It's always the man whose love is thought worthy of recording. Have you noticed that? In all the chronicles, they state it so. Well, you write down that it was I. I was the one who loved.
That's just a snippet from about a third of the way into Geraldine Brooks' The Secret Chord. And when you read on, it gets intense when she describes what all happens. This is New Letters on the Air. As you were drawing these people, I read that you like to find a scaffolding that you can fill things in.
I like the facts to be the scaffold, so in as far as you can know what really happened, I do tend to make a great effort to find it out, probably more than most people who are writing a novel where there's a lot of freedom. If you say it's a novel, you can do anything with the facts. But I tend to want to be as close to the factual basis as I can, because I think if you have that as your scaffolding, then it's more likely I can take the reader to a wonderfully fanciful place when the facts run out and I have to invent. It's more likely that you'll believe my invention if I've laid in that scaffolding properly.
The secret chord, I would imagine just having to tell the story of David, which a lot of people, you know, who read the Bible will be very familiar with what they discover in the Bible. But what else did you look at in your research?
His life is packed with incident. The biblical account is the first story of a human being that we have told from first to last, from early childhood to extreme old age. So really, he's the first man that we know in full. But it's told,
which is fascinating, because I had not really thought of it in that way.
Yeah. You know, and this predates Herodotus, who's thought to be the first biographical historian, by half a millennium. So it's really quite an early life to be told so fully. But it's told with great economy, and it's packed with incident. And so every little piece of it gets a very abbreviated treatment. So I wanted to let some of the more interesting to me incidents speak more fully. And it was a completely different exercise to anything I've ever done before, because there are no written sources on David outside of the Bible, no sources from his own time. So all we've got is, you know, archaeological evidence about material culture of Israel in the Second Iron Age, which is the period that he's thought to have lived and ruled. So there's a lot of factual detail that you can gather about what the population was and what kind of buildings they built and what they ate and how they fought and what weaponry they had and who they traded with. But to get to the nature of life there, you have to really do something different. So what I did was I took my youngest son, who was 10 at the time, and we went to Israel and we visited all the places that are associated with David. And as much as you still can, we tried to do things that he might have done, like herding sheep on a sunny hillside for an afternoon, or hiding out in the caves behind Ein Gedi where he was with his outlaw band when Saul had turned against him, and things of that nature. So we spent an afternoon riding camels, and then we found out that we got sore backsides for nothing because there were no camels in Second Iron Age Israel. Mules were what we needed to be riding.
Nevertheless, to ride a camel, that's exciting for a 10-year-old boy, I think. What a great idea to take him along and help you with the research.
I've exploited my children in this way for a number of years because I found very early on that they see things with these wonderfully unjaded eyes and they ask questions that wouldn't occur to us. We take too much for granted.
Now, I read that one of your sons is a harpist.
That's right. That's what and
David,
started me on this journey. Yes.
Is that part of it? That's the same 10-year-old boy that you
took?
No,
that's my oldest son. So this book was brewing for quite a while. He decided that he would take up the harp when he was 9, and he's 19 now, so it's been 10 years. But it was looking at him at music lessons dwarfed by this huge, beautiful concert instrument that his teacher had. And thinking, what a strange choice for a boy. You know, I was thinking drums, you know. And I was so glad it turned out to be the harp because it turns out it's the best instrument to learn music on because you can't make a bad sound. Even when you're playing appallingly badly, it still sounds pretty good. So he always got smiled at when he practiced instead of grimaced.
Yeah.
And nobody said, I'll cut that out. You know, we were always very glad to hear him practicing.
That's neat. So the harp becomes an instrumental part of the secret chord. Do you mind reading another passage?
I'd be glad to.
Okay. And the harp is part of the character in this scene.
So this is a sort of a crux in David's life. He's been told he can't lead his troops in battle anymore because he's approaching middle age, and the last battle he was at, he was almost killed. He's forged the tribes of Israel into a nation, and they don't think that he should take this risk. And so he's pretty bummed about that. It's the first time he's been told that he has to stay behind. And so Natan and Yoav have decided to give him something to do. They have invited him to sit down and basically write his memoirs. And so Natan is trying to talk him into this, and David is quite reluctant. Your line will not fail, you know this, yet memory surely will. Your sons, what will they remember? Or their sons after? When all who knew you in life are but bleached bone and dust, your descendants, your people, will crave to understand what manner of man you were when you did these deeds, first and last. Not just the deeds, the man. He gazed at me for a long moment. His face was unreadable. He picked up a low carved stool then, and when I moved to take it from him, he waved me off. He carried it to the harp and settled himself to play. As an afterthought, he motioned me to sit, so I sank gratefully upon the pillows and let out the breath I had not even realized I was holding. He tilted the tall harp, settling it against his shoulder gently, as a woman settles her infant. His fingers rolled a few idle triplets, but his gaze was fixed on the distant view of hills, the olive trees silver in the sunlight. It is true what you say. Oleanger was gone from his voice. When I was a youth, learning war, I often thought of it. We hear of men like Shalmaneser or Sargon who won great battles, of Ramses who built the mighty temples on the backs of our ancestors, or of Hammurabi who they say ruled with wise laws. But these are names only. It would be something to know their nature, to know them as men. He paused, his eyes still distant. To be known as a man. His fingertips pressed harder against the strings. His hands were strong, but the fingers were slender, moving swiftly through the tall strings, weaving sound from the filaments. It was as if the harp were a loom, the notes he drew from it a bright thread forming a splendid pattern. He played this way often, even interrupting meetings with his generals. He said that the music, its order and precision, helped him find the patterns in things, the way through the confusion of events and opinions to direction, to order, and beyond, to inspiration. He played for some time. I do not know if he was improvising or playing from memory. The melody was sweet, intricate, and soothing. You could read his mind through his music, always. I felt the tension in my body easing. I had been braced against his anger and his grief, but the music revealed a mellowing of his mood. Finally, he brought it to an end in a graceful run of notes and set the harp back upright. He turned his eyes on me. They were not cold now, but the expression remained opaque. Catch a true likeness. See a plain reflection in the water of the well. You will not like the flaws revealed in the face that stares back at you. I struggled to suppress a smile. I could not imagine that his own reflection had ever given him much grief. The golden shimmer of his youth had been tempered like worked metal in his adult years, so that even now in middle age he gleamed. Years had brought only distinction to a beauty that had proved irresistible to men and women alike. But he was serious, deep in consideration of what I had said. I thought it best to add nothing further, to let the line of his thought lead him to his own conclusions. He commenced to play again, but after a time his fingers paused and hovered above the strings. He turned his face to me. Perhaps I can prove myself brave in this, at least. I will consider it. Now go. As the young guard's spears hit the floor and the door closed behind me, he started to play in earnest. His large, strong hands could draw forth a breadth of sound that one did not generally associate with the gentle harp. He could make it speak with a thousand voices, soft or stormy. He did so now. And then, that other instrument over which he had full mastery, his voice.
That's Geraldine Brooks. She just read a passage from her novel, The Secret Chord, and this is New Letters on the Air.
And actually, the thing about the big hands, as my son grew up, he became a running back on the high school football team.
But he's still playing running back.
He said, Mom, I love telling people I'm the only harpist on the football team. But his hands got really strong. And so I'd see, you know, these hands that were in the receiver's gloves one day and then on the harp the next day. And it was true. He really played with great power. And that's what inspired me to do that description.
Oh, that's wonderful. I also love it because it has something to do with Natan. He's trying to get the tales down and this whole idea of getting the stories out there so that you know the man.
The interesting thing is, it says in the Book of Chronicles that Natan actually did write the life of David, and it says all the acts of the king from first to last were set down by the prophet Nathan. And yet we don't have the Book of Nathan. It's lost to us. But when you're thinking about this character, Nathan, whose main role in the story is to criticize the king and tell him when he's failed, that's his principal duty in the books of Samuel. That's where we meet him. What kind of a book would he have written? So this is really my attempt to imagine the Book of Nathan.
It's too bad it wasn't in with the Dead Sea Scrolls or something.
Well, it might still be there, waiting to be discovered.
Wouldn't that be something?
Actually, one of my readers had a wonderful sort of Dan Brown-esque suggestion that it might be sequestered in a vault in the Vatican because it contains things that the church doesn't want us to know.
I read that your husband, who's the writer Tony Horowitz, is Jewish and that you've converted to Judaism.
I did. It was not a very difficult decision for me. I was raised Catholic, Irish family, went to convent school, very grateful to the nuns. They were fantastic teachers. But in my teens, I became very disillusioned with the role of women in the Catholic Church. And so I had fallen out of my earlier faith and I was cruising contentedly as a non-believer. And when I realized that I would be marrying a Jewish man, I'd always been impressed by the fact that Judaism is passed through the maternal line traditionally, which I find very pragmatic. And also feminist. So I wasn't going to be the end of the line for that family that survived the Holocaust and the Russian pogroms and the sacking of the temple. You know, it just wasn't going to end on my watch. So I guess it was a gesture to history more than anything else to convert.
Interesting. Did you do it before the boys were born?
Oh,
afterwards?
I did it before we were married.
Before you were married?
Yes. Yep.
I would imagine that there's a lot of study involved.
Yes, and I love converting. That. I'm fascinated by comparative religion, so this was a chance to bore down into a subject that just interests me so much. And I feel very lucky that my life has led me through a close relationship with three great faiths, really, Catholicism and Judaism in my personal life, and then in my career to be in Islamic countries at a time of great tumult and change in the way people related to their Islamic faith was also a fascinating part of my life.
I would imagine being a journalist and dealing with countries that are war-torn or have a lot going on, like the story you related about Africa, that sort of knowledge would come in very handy as a novelist, because you do choose things that are on the edge of real change to write about.
I think I couldn't write these novels if I hadn't had those 10 or more years as a journalist covering modern catastrophes, because you're intimately thrown into people's lives at possibly their lowest moment. And, you know, you see the huge range of responses that human beings have to a crisis and to the tests that come with it. And I saw every possible reaction. Some people become morally lost, torturers, and completely inhumane and barbaric in their behavior one to another. And then other people become heroic and amazingly capable of great acts of kindness and generosity and courage. And often it was the women that interested me the most, because these were women often from societies where they were led to expect that their life would be extremely domestic and circumscribed. And then the crisis hits and the men are away. They've either been arrested or they've been killed or they're off fighting. And it's the women who have to step out of the role that they've been assigned and save their families, because there's nobody else to do it. It's certainly given me the courage to imagine women characters very fully and to allow them to be capable of great change.
When you finish one book, are you casting about trying to find subject matter for the other, or are you working simultaneously on things?
It's not that I'm working simultaneously, but I always know what the next book is, because the idea comes to you and it's almost like a seduction, because you've got the project that you're working on. And every single time I fall in love with the idea, and then you marry the idea and you're working on the book and you realize that the idea snores and it doesn't do the dishes and all the realities. And so you're enmeshed in this book where you know what it's really like to write this book. And it's as if you went to a party and you see this glamorous stranger across the room and you're about to fall in love, but you realize you have to leave with the one that brought you. But that seductive idea is there waiting for you to be finished with the book in hand.
Geraldine Brooks. Her next book is still hush-hush, but will probably involve a horse race or two. In the meantime, you can read her 2015 novel, The Secret Chord, published by Viking. For links, visit our website, newletters.org, where you can also sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or find us on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Timothy Larrison, Abby Jamison, Renita Johnson, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.